Hello and welcome to the King's Fund podcast, where we explore the big issues and ideas in health and care. I'm your host for this episode, Ruth Robertson. The NHS has risen to the top spot in public polls of the most important issues facing Britain today. People care deeply about it, yet public satisfaction with the NHS is at an all-time low. We don't yet know when a general election might be called, but we do know that health and care will play a significant role in the election campaign. So, in this episode, we're examining what is happening in health and care. We'll cover how the NHS is performing, how the workforce is bearing up, and what the public think. I'm delighted to be joined by a panel of my King's Fund colleagues, Sally, Toby and Saoirse. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi Ruth, I'm Sally Warren, the Director of Policy here at the King's Fund.
I'm Toby Brown, I'm the Senior Policy Lead in the External Affairs team at the King's Fund.
I'm Saoirse Mallory and I'm a Senior Analyst in the Policy team.
Let's start with how health and care services are performing. I know this is something that you track as part of your role, Saoirse. So could I start by asking you to give us a bit of a summary about where services are at after the winter period?
So the short answer is that they're not doing very well. Despite a slightly better winter for things like flu, when you look at performance statistics, they remain grim. The waiting list remains at 7.6 million, over 300,000 of whom have been waiting over a year. Last month, 44,000 people waited over 12 hours in A&E from a decision to admit to actually being admitted. These numbers are no longer remarkable. This is in danger of becoming the norm. And what's also concerning is that these performance statistics that I'm talking about, they're very much where government and NHS focuses on. Other services such as community or preventative services may be struggling even more given they're not the priority.
It's really hard to hear those numbers. They sound awful. And Sally, how do you think it feels now compared to the past?
In the late 1990s, we had very long waits for each different part of our hospital treatment pathway. But what was different between then and now is really the sheer scale of services which are impacted. So in the late 1990s, it was mainly the acute sector that was under a performance pressure, but people were still very much able to access their GP and highly satisfied with what the care they were receiving in primary care. What we see now is whether it's the acute sector, urgent emergency care, primary care, dentistry, all of those services we're seeing under a huge amount of pressure.
The kind of obsession with performance, and particularly hospital performance and waiting times in A&E or electives, is a bit of a self-defeating cycle that means we plough all our energy and attention into trying to reduce these numbers, whereas we forget the kind of underlying solutions or the longer term solutions, whether that's around investing in a more healthy society through more preventative measures. We know that you're more likely to live longer if you're born in Germany or Sweden or France or Greece. Likewise, we know that there's lots of people leaving the service and we need to make sure there's enough people that the NHS needs. And we also need to make sure we're moving care away from hospitals so that there's space for in hospitals for the sickest patients, but there's more primary community social care to try and make sure that in 5 or 10 years' time, the waiting lists are coming down, but actually the model has changed so there are less people going into hospital. And I think the other point to note around that is just the political cycle doesn't help at all here, because it really is going to take quite a long-term vision for this, because it's like a big oil tanker. You're trying to turn it around. And at the moment, totally understandably, the government is trying to show some short-term progress to say to the electorate, we've reduced waiting time. So it's kind of a bit of a vicious, self-defeating cycle at the moment, I'd say.
Sally.
One of the things to reflect about these kind of slightly more hidden services and the fact that therefore there's quite a lot of focus on the services which either politicians think the public rate more highly or where we've got more data is to actually reflect on the reality of people's lives who are trying to interact with the NHS. So we've got many, many more people in our population with multiple long-term conditions. They need to interact with lots of different services. So this isn't like it was 30 or 40 years ago where the NHS could fix you and send you off home again. This is about a long-term relationship between patients and the NHS. And it means individuals need lots of services to support them. And if all of those services are struggling to be able to provide timely access to services, as a patient, the burden you can hold trying to navigate through all of those different pathways that you're on and trying to get the right treatment and support in the right order is a real, real challenge. So I think we've got to step away from thinking about individual services and think about the experience the patients are having, and they will be finding it extremely difficult to navigate. And staff will be finding it frustrating because they'll know that as well. They'll know that they're kind of having one-off interactions when the patient needs continuity of care and support through their pathways.
Yeah, I guess when a service is under pressure or an individual working to deliver care is under pressure, it's just so natural to focus on delivering the specifics of the care and job that you've been employed to do, and maybe that extra work that's needed to kind of coordinate with the other people working in other teams and other services, it can become a bit too much. And I hadn't really thought about the fact that burden gets transferred onto the patient and their family often. We talked about the politics a little bit there, Toby, and I know we've just had the spring budget. Can someone take me through the key announcements in that and what they mean for health and care performance?
So there was the kind of surprise money, as it were, that the rabbit for the NHS was an extra $3.5 billion going into technology and innovation. There is also commitments around improving maternity services, around investment in life-saving treatments for dementia and other diseases. And there's also $2 billion for real day-to-day spending, which was, I think most commentators say, to cover the pay increases for staff. My reflections on the spring budget announcements go back to what I was saying previously, which is that it's all very much welcome. And given that the NHS was and has been for a long time prioritised over other public services in a very, very tight kind of fiscal environment where the economy is not growing enough, it's good to have that investment. But often it is piecemeal, or it's not thinking totally long term, because the political cycle coming up to an election, and it's harder to say we're going to invest X amount over the next 5 years at a time where the government's making tax cuts and saying that the public sector are going to get on average about a 1% increase in the years to come, which is really going taking us back to kind of what the levels of public investment were during the austerity period after the 2010s.
Just to illustrate the short-termism, this year is going to be the year that the planning guidance for the NHS has gone out, the latest it has ever gone out. It used to be planning guidance would go out in December or possibly early January to help give the NHS a kind of clarity about this is the funding you've got for the year and these are your performance expectations. We're now at the point with kind of days to go before the financial year starts. The NHS doesn't have that certainty. You can't plan a £150 billion healthcare service on that basis. So just goes to really emphasise the point about short-termism being a really unhelpful way to plan effectively, deliver services effectively, be able to really think about healthcare. I think the second point I'd make about the budget is obviously the NHS was the kind of headline grabbing public service part of the budget. But what that means is lots of other public services, which are absolutely critical for the wider determinants of health, are really, really struggling and will continue to struggle. So local government, for example, we know are in absolute dire straits. What, 8 councils have had to, in effect, declare bankruptcy. Lots more are saying that they're concerned they're going to need to, and they don't think they're financially sustainable. So the services which local government runs, 70% of them are children's social services, adult social services, support for homelessness. A lot are then around wider determinants like access to libraries, green spaces, active travel. We've got a budget which, again, is kind of trying to patch up the NHS without thinking about how do you, as a state, support the health of your entire population and not just support the treatment of sickness.
I wanted to follow up on this point about short-termism and the difficulty planning in the health system at the moment. You know, we talk about that a lot in our role as kind of policy analysts, and we know that kind of long-term sustainable funding and clarity that allows the health service to plan over 10, 20 years is what's needed to address some of these fundamental kind of wider determinants of health, focusing upstream, kind of getting the tanker to turn. how realistic is it for us to think that's possible? Are there areas within healthcare or beyond that where government policy does take that longer term view and has succeeded? Or is this just a kind of natural characteristic of politics that we're really never going to be able to change?
So I think it's a really good challenge, Ruth. And I think for me, there's a bit about the realism of when we talk about long term versus short term, what do we really mean? So right now, short term, it's 6 months. Sometimes it's even shorter than that. So sometimes money is being allocated in winter, in January, that must be spent by the end of March. So it's a really short-term bung of cash. And that is a really unhelpful way to plan services. It's a pretty inefficient way to spend taxpayers' money.
Just to come in off the back of that, I think it's really important to think about national leadership and what role politics has to play in this. Because since 2012, there's been a mantra of like taking politics out of the NHS, which I think has a lot of merit to it because of the short-termism. But when you look at how much is spent on the health system, how much of taxpayers' money, what is it, $180 billion a year? When you think back to history, some would say it goes all the way to the Prime Minister, whether that's Tony Blair committing to European levels of health spending, whether that's Boris Johnson leading the way on the vaccine rollout and maybe taking some risks that other people or maybe public servants who weren't political wouldn't have made, or whether it's the Labour government and the smoking ban, as Sally said, or Rishi Sunak at the minute talking about banning vaping and a smoke-free generation. A lot of these big policy decisions that have made a lot of impact have been because there's been significant political heft behind them.
When we talk about NHS performance, that can feel like quite a sort of technical, distant thing. But really what we're talking about is millions of people coming into work each day, doing their job, trying to kind of deliver services or develop services. So, Sally, how do you see that connection between the workforce and performance playing out at the moment?
So I think for people working in the NHS, they absolutely want to do the best they can every day to be able to support their patients. And they will, in many cases, think it's absolutely right to have high expectations of performance. But the reality is they're coming into work, be it in a hospital, in a community setting, in a GP practice, and finding that they don't have the resources to be able to do their very best that day. And that might be resources about a number of staff, a number of colleagues they have on the shift that day. It might also be about the physical resources. So in the last couple of weeks, we've seen stories of ceilings falling down in operating theatres, of doctors breaking their legs because lifts fell through lift shafts. This shouldn't be happening in modern hospital buildings. So you can understand staff feeling really that the system doesn't support them to do their best. And then the next thing that can create is that when we see all of these headlines about really poor performance, staff can feel really, that can increase the kind of sense of stress and the sense that they're not able to do what they want to do. So almost it becomes a slightly self-fulfilling. People find it really stressful to be working in the NHS, and that leads to greater burnout, which kind of then starts to fill the cycle again in terms of people leaving. So I think it feels so different from, you know, 4 years ago when people were clapping in the street to say thank you to NHS staff. Now I think if you're working in the NHS, you can feel really like it's kind of the pressure's never ending, and you're not able to meet the expectations of your patients and your community, and that can also be really hard for you to then maintain motivation and energy to do your really difficult work every day.
And we are, I guess, lucky in the NHS that we have a barometer that helps us understand how staff are affected by all this terrible things that you just outlined there. This month, we had the release of the latest results of the annual NHS staff survey. Saoirse, I know you've looked at that data. What does it tell us about how the health service workforce is feeling at the moment?
So to me, I think in some areas, in the interests of fairness, it is important to point out that staff, I wouldn't go so far as to say we're happy, but we're a bit less unhappy than last year, which is a positive thing and which we shouldn't take away from. Having said that, though, there were so many causes for concern throughout the survey. Staff are suffering from overwork, not having enough staff in their organisation. Only a third of staff agreed that there were enough staff at their organisation for them to do their job properly. 2 in 5 staff report feeling unwell due to work-related stress. That rises to over half of paramedics and midwives. 3 in 10 staff report feeling burnt out at the end of the day. I could go on, and that's only looking at the stress side of things. There are concerns elsewhere as well. So, for example, looking at the likelihood of staff experiencing discrimination, and this is discrimination from other colleagues, that's 9% of staff at the moment, which is an increase over time, and which is substantially higher for ethnic minority or staff with disabilities. Only about half of staff feel their organisation acts fairly when it comes to career progression. So you can see in here that there's problems with the culture as well as with the workload, all of which leads to greater dissatisfaction and an unsurprising figure that 29% often think of leaving.
We do, as Saoirse said, we've got some significant issues with culture and behaviour, and actually credit to the NHS for this year, including for the first time a question on sexual harassment. It's really important that we do start to record it. It's fairly horrific that the number of people who say they are subject of harassment, either from colleagues or from the public, but it's better that we know that. And then we start to have a baseline and can start to think, how can the service act to improve that, rather than just thinking, let's not even ask the question. So I think it's a really good thing that we have this survey. It's a really good thing that it's every year. But I think it's going to be a slow and steady and up and down recovery from this. It's not going to be a kind of smooth and fast improvement.
And we can't have a conversation about the health and care workforce without talking about industrial action. The last year has been seen a record amount of industrial action strikes from the NHS workforce. What kind of impact is that having on services and staff?
I mean, there's an immediate kind of an obvious set of implications, which is that services can't be delivered on days of strikes or need to be delivered in a different way. So actually the public may see their appointments being cancelled or being moved. Staff who aren't striking are needing to kind of cover and make sure there's kind of minimum requirements to deliver kind of core services. So there's a kind of immediate impact that's kind of, if you like, the most visible impact. But I think you can then start to think, actually, there's probably a deeper set of implications. Some of that's around, actually, for staff who are striking. There's a financial consequence of them striking. So they'll be starting to feel that impact as the industrial action goes on for longer and longer. For staff who are covering, there will be some practical things about they will be tired and more exhausted because they're covering over these periods. But also they'll start to feel a kind of that sense of, if you like, moral injury around what they can and can't do, how much they can and can't support on the day of the strike versus what they'd like to deliver in a normal day of service. So I think there's an impact on staff. There's also an impact on, really important to talk about, a hidden kind of workforce of all of the admin teams who are having to phone up and get appointments rescheduled with patients who are anxious and worried and quite often in pain. Then when you think about patients and the public, some patients, their care will be immediately impacted. But I think you'll also start to have a wider sense that the public will start to think, should I present if I feel unwell during a strike? Should I be coming to A&E or should I not? Should I be going to that appointment or should I not? They might start to question, do they have confidence that the NHS will be there for them if they need it? So I think there becomes a bit of a longer term sense of what's the public's confidence in the NHS if we continue to see industrial action at the scale we've seen for the last year.
Saoirse?
I'd say, just to add yet another impact, to point out that obviously strikes have a financial cost to the NHS, which has been well publicised, but the money that it costs can also lead to a change of behaviour among those trying to figure out how to fund services. If someone is there thinking, oh, well, there might be strikes next year, maybe we'd better save some money for that instead of putting the money into rebuilding a leaky roof, instead of investing in technology, whatever it might be. It can lead to a whole different way of decision making where things that aren't absolutely essential get deprioritized.
Yeah, and I guess this is another way in which planning is particularly difficult in the health service at the moment, another kind of uncertainty and complexity when looking to try and allocate resources and plan for the year.
It is important to note that compared to Western European countries, other comparable countries, we have some of the lowest percentage of managers and administrative staff in our health service. And you hear a lot of the public debate about bureaucracy, about waste, and yet we need to, and hopefully politicians and the NHS and others can recognise that we've got into a really bad place where actually we're probably seeing maybe poor productivity and waste because we don't have people looking at how to improve the way we're delivering services. We're asking our clinicians or our nurses or our other staff who are supposed to be treating patients to do that difficult thinking as well. So I think we should be challenging those who are making decisions to think about what the right level of managerial and administrative staff should be to help improve the efficiency of the services.
Definitely. Thank you, Toby. The landscape of the health and care system in England is challenging and complex, and the system is facing profound challenges. At our event this June, Health and Care Explained, policy and leadership experts from the King's Fund will help you gain a greater understanding of how the health and care system in England works and how it is changing, giving a balanced and honest view about the pressures and opportunities it faces. Sign up via the link in the show notes. Let's move on to talk a bit about public views on the NHS. And I guess it's important to set out up front that the public isn't something completely separate to the health and care system and the policy world. The people who work in the NHS or develop policy are members of the public and patients too, or the public have friends and family working in those roles. What do we know about how the public feel towards health and care services at the moment?
Earlier this month, Ruth, we published the latest in the British Social Attitudes, which is a gold standard of understanding public satisfaction that's been published every year since 1983. So it can give us a really long sense of understanding how the public feel about the NHS. And unfortunately, what it tells us is we are at the types of historic lows that we have never experienced in those 40 years. So in the data we published alongside colleagues in Nuffield Trust just earlier this month, 24% of the public is satisfied with the NHS. This is the lowest it's ever been in 40 years. It's dropped 29 percentage points since 2020. So an absolutely staggering pace of drop in satisfaction. Also means, and slightly unsurprisingly, if satisfaction is dropping that quickly into those kind of low levels, dissatisfaction is now at 52% of the population are dissatisfied with the NHS. And again, that's the highest that's ever been. A couple of important things to bear in mind, though, when we think about satisfaction, is it's not only satisfaction with the NHS as a whole that's at historic lows. Actually, we also ask about individual services like hospital services, GPs, dentistry, and those are all also at historic lows, either in 2022 or 2023. So we're seeing really low levels of satisfaction across all services. But again, really important to say that isn't translating into the public saying they don't support the model of the NHS. So we asked them, do they still agree with the principles of the NHS, that it should be free at the point of use, available to everybody, primarily funded through taxation? And the levels of support are extremely high. So what this tells us is the public don't want a new model. They want the NHS, but they want it to work for them. And at the moment, they're finding it that it just isn't working for them. It's too difficult for them to get timely access to the care they need, whether that's dentistry, primary care, inpatient, or ambulances.
I'm just struck by this idea of collapse, of public satisfaction collapsing, buildings collapsing. It's quite a bleak picture we're painting here.
I suspect that what's sitting under some of the satisfaction figures is also that how you access care is changing. So if we think about primary care, for example, it's now quite different about how you access, depending on what your need is. Sometimes you are seen by your GP, sometimes you're seen by a pharmacist in the practice, sometimes by a nurse, sometimes your medicine review is done remotely, sometimes you need to be in person. And I think sometimes it can be hard as a patient to sort of understand how you're meant to navigate, and that can increase your dissatisfaction. So I think a lot of this is also how do we work with communities so they can help us design services so they better meet their needs, but also so communities are aware of how to engage with services.
There's a kind of like, how could this have happened? And I think it's important to say that there has been for the past 14 years if you look at the average amount spent on the health service over many decades, it has received lower than average levels of funding over a prolonged period of time, and the funding has gone into the kind of day-to-day short term, making sure the most kind of critical, if you're really really sick, you get seen kind of services over public health services, social care services, capital investment. Those things have been on the back burner. So there is a reason for it. Just to slightly take us off on a tangent, we know that they support more interventions in public health. We know there is public backing for reducing salt and sugary foods, the salt and sugar in foods. There's public support for reducing or restricting advertising targeting junk food at kids. So I think when we're looking at what the public think, yes, look at what they think about satisfaction with the NHS, but we also know the NHS comes top one or two as an election issue.
And this does feel like an area where government has taken some bold action recently, for example, on smoking. Do you think there's appetite there or to do more?
It's an interesting example of a prime minister and a politician kind of pulling a lever that they have control over. It's a no-brainer in some ways. The public support it. And then when you look at the prime minister's announced to have a smoke-free generation, so anyone born from 2009 onwards, it would be illegal for them to buy cigarettes. And at the same time, this legislation is due to tackle or restrict vaping, especially for children, and prevent these kind of brightly coloured packets and fancy names being targeted at children. So I think it's a really positive development. It does need to get through Parliament. Who knows when there'll be an election? So, I mean, you have to caution that. But if it does, it'll be another really, really significant step forward, just like the sugar tax was that I think George Osborne announced, thinking he would get a massive backlash and then didn't. And then you've got the Labour government and the smoking ban in public places. So I guess the question for politicians going forward is, will they have the bravery to go beyond tobacco and smoking or children's health into other areas?
And I think that question, Toby, about are they brave enough to go further, for me, is the really interesting and important one, because actually with tobacco, at one level, it's quite simple. Your ambition is to get to a point of zero consumption of tobacco. And you can use all of your policy levers, and government has been, over the last 25 years, been using it strategically to reduce the amount of smoking in society, and hopefully now move to a kind of generational shift, which would be amazing. But when you get to some of the other areas of public health, the aim isn't about getting consumption to zero. We all need to eat food, but it's about the nature of the food we eat. So it's a much more nuanced policy aim. It's a much more nuanced communication message to the public.
I want to just bring in one more topic. Saoirse, I know you've done work recently looking at the relationship between poverty and NHS services, something that feels so important at the moment, given the state we're in, the cost of living crisis, the challenge people living in communities are kind of experiencing every day. What did you learn from that work?
I'm afraid this is going to be yet another depressing answer. This was analysing already existing data and talking to people in the NHS to try and understand the relationship between poverty and both individuals' health and how they access and interact with the NHS. And the findings, to an extent, were unsurprising, that living in poverty is bad for a person's health across the board, whether that's making it harder to afford nutritious food, more likely to engage in health-related risks, substandard housing, the list goes on. What I think was also very concerning was that we could see a clear correlation between a person's level of poverty and how they made use of the NHS, that it's a lot harder for more deprived groups or areas to access the NHS at earlier stages. If you're struggling to pay your phone bill, you can't be ringing up at 8 a.m. every morning to try and get a GP appointment. Taking time off work to go to a screening service, for example, could well also be an unaffordable luxury. All of which means that between suffering from poorer health and being unable to access earlier stage services means that there was also a strong correlation between poverty and accessing later stage services. People in the most deprived 10% of areas in the country were nearly twice as likely to attend A&E than those in the least deprived areas. And it also leads, depressingly but inevitably, to huge inequalities in health outcomes, that men in the most deprived areas live nearly a decade less than men in the least deprived areas.
I wanted to add a couple of reflections. One was to kind of think about the role of the NHS when it comes to the impact of poverty on its own services. So through the work we did, we saw some really good examples of local services really thinking about sort of poverty proofing their services, how to make it easier for people who are living in poverty to be able to engage with services, how to be able to think through what are some of the current barriers and what they can do locally, and also for them to think through to what extent their own staff are living in poverty as well and what they can do as an employer. So there's definitely agency that the NHS has to be able to make some progress on this area. But it's also an area where it absolutely requires a much broader set of actions than just the NHS alone. It needs national government, business, civic society as a whole to really, really grasp the scale of the challenge here, and particularly to think about the number of children living in poverty and just how much that sets them up for life. For me, this comes back to some of the issues we've discussed today around the balance between thinking about prioritising money into the NHS, which is treating, if you like, the symptoms of poverty, versus investing in services that can support tackling the causes of poverty. So we've talked about the budget, we know about the money that's going into the NHS this year, but we've also then seen briefings saying at the next fiscal event, the Prime Minister may well look to tackle the benefits bill again. Not clear to me that there's any ability to cut that benefits bill, given the sheer number of people who are receiving benefits and still living in poverty. So some really, really big challenges about how does government choose to invest in public services to support individuals and families and communities who are finding themselves really stuck in poverty in numbers which are absolutely shocking.
Thanks, Sally. And we've spoken a lot today about the challenges facing the health and care system and the challenging experiences that the public and patients are having, and staff as a result of that. I wonder if we could finish with some reasons to be hopeful.
I'm hopeful because the public continue to support the principles of the NHS. They continue to put it at the top one or two of their issues at the next election. So despite this kind of conversation about tax cuts at the minute and not spending on public services, I think the public wants to see political parties telling them how they're going to improve the health service. And I think that that is a powerful, you know, with a government and a prime minister that has a fresh mandate from the public, I think they can make progress on what is going to be difficult decisions, and it's going to cause arguments across different sections of the health service, the reform that may or may not come. So I'm kind of optimistic about that. I'm also hopeful because I was speaking to a junior doctor friend of mine who was talking about just how virtual wards have completely like changed the way that she feels about delivering services in her geriatric unit, and how they've been brilliant. And so there's definitely room for more innovation and more technology, and the fact we have a workforce plan. Sorry if I'm stealing other people's hopes here, but there was a workforce plan. So even, you know, the mantra of small incremental change, now we have that's the foundation to build from.
Thanks so much, Toby. Saoirse.
Yeah, I definitely agree with those. I think it's been really heartening to hear, albeit at a small scale, of initiatives going on that really are making a tangible difference to people's lives, whether community champions projects, poverty-proofing services, as Sally mentioned, that despite the massive pressures the system is under, providers are still finding ways to innovate and to really improve the services that they're offering.
And finally, Sally.
I think I'm going to steal from Professor Chris Whitty, the Chief Medical Officer, for my reason to be hopeful. He quite often reflects on, if you look back over the 75 years history of the NHS or over, you know, 150 years of medicine, actually we've made huge progress as a society in terms of innovation in treatment, increasing people's life expectancy, being able to manage pain. So huge improvements, most of which have been made in small steps. I think sometimes when you're in the moment of it feeling like it's all impossible, you kind of don't quite recognise that it probably felt impossible at other points in the history of the NHS as well. There are a number of reasons to be hopeful, and, you know, lots of people will talk about technology and digital and AI, and I think those are all absolutely right from how you can deliver services. But also the bit that really gives me hope is that we are still, as a system, talking about inequalities. We're talking about how to better serve the needs of underserved communities, how to better work alongside communities to be able to understand their health needs, design services within the work. And that feels to me like a very significant change to where we've been over the last 10 or 15 years. And I hope that's something that we keep core to how health and care is thinking about transforming its services, because that feels demonstrably different to me. It feels like it would lead to a different type of NHS and a different type of service.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed the conversation today, despite the slightly challenging topic. I'm left thinking about how national policy and how staff and patients are really affected by the lack of investment going into the health and care system, and the creation of this environment where planning and a long-term approach is so difficult, and it almost feels like we're actually nurturing short-termism. And the national approach is making that more difficult. But at the same time, there's really these beacons of hope, because you talked about these step changes that are possible by big legal changes, big policies that bring around massive improvements in public health, like the approach to smoking. And it sounds like there's both government action in those areas and a public appetite to make a change. So I guess I'm left reflecting on both the positives and negatives of national action to improve health. But that's all we've got time for today. So thank you all for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Ruth. It was great to join you all.
The show notes for this episode and all our previous episodes can be found at www.kingsfund.org.uk/KF podcast. And you can get in touch with us via X. Our account is @TheKingsFund. The producer for this episode was Emma Sheffield, and it has been edited by Bespoken Media. Don't forget to subscribe, share, rate, and review this episode wherever you get your podcasts. And of course, thank you for listening. We hope you will join us next time.